Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com.
Hi, everyone. This is Mikey McGovern, and you're listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. So, it's been a little while, and I managed to leave for the summer and make it through part of the year without publishing some interviews that actually took place back in July. So, first up in my series of long overdue interviews is with Robert Brain, Associate Professor of History at the University of British Columbia, about his fascinating new book, The Pulse of Modernism, Physiological Aesthetics in Fin de Siècle Europe, published in 2015 by the University of Washington Press. In recent history of science, it has become commonplace to call attention to a kind of aestheticism made possible by the rise of mechanical instruments for observation, notably of the sort observed by Dastin and Galison in their celebrated book, Objectivity. The Pulse of Modernism looks at different material that is no less implicated in the rise of mechanical observation techniques, yet describes a very different trajectory. Physiological recording instruments produced representations that were interpreted as affording a new kind of vibratory vitality to life, and the enthusiasm for its application to various domains even gave rise to the use of these techniques in early modernist art. The result is an engaging exploration of physiological aesthetics between scientific and artistic theory and practice, from James Watt to George Seurat, and beyond. This is a fantastic book, and the union of art and science will surely be of interest to a broad audience. I strongly recommend it to those interested in European science and philosophy, particularly the rise of experimentation, visual studies of science and technology, and the cultural history and theory of art.
Hi, everyone. This is Mikey McGovern, and you're listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm here today with Robert Brain, Associate Professor of History at the University of British Columbia, today to speak about his new book, The Pulse of Modernism, Physiological Aesthetics in Fin de Siècle Europe. Robert, welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society.
Thank you, Mikey.
So we like to get started on the network by having all of our authors unpack their own intellectual trajectory and sort of how the present work came about. So what brought you to the subject in the first place, and how has this shaped and been shaped by your own career writ large?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, as many things in my career, they're somewhat nonlinear, but I'll try to make them as linear as I can. I come from a kind of mixed background, philosophy of science, then into history of science, then into European history. And the focus of – I had a broad education in history of science in Europe and at the University of Wisconsin and at UCLA. And at UCLA, I did a lot of European history, and I focused particularly on the late 19th century as well. My intellectual focus in the history of science tended to be biomedical disciplines. And I began by working on a dissertation which I initially thought would be on medical instrumentation in the 19th century. And I quickly found in doing this work that the instruments that I was interested in, particularly graphical recording instruments in the 19th century, had really migrated across a number of disciplines, from engineering to physics to physiology to medicine, and then from there outward to a range of other disciplines like psychology, linguistics, and a number of practical disciplines and so on. So I ended up writing about graphical methods across the board in my dissertation. And I was fascinated by – this was at the moment, of course, of early computer algorithms migrating between disparate kinds of areas. And I was interested in this kind of analog instrumentation, a relatively simple form of instrumentation in the 19th century, but that had done something similar, that had migrated across different areas. And then I was interested in the kinds of things that needed to be done to make this new technique work in a different domain, how to reconceptualize the phenomena, how to recalibrate and design new kinds of instruments and so on. But the more immediate origin for this work really probably could be traced back to my postdoctoral work that I did at Cambridge in a collaborative project with several other people. And there we were interested in science and society in the late 19th and early 20th century. And what we were interested in particular was the way the laboratory, as a relatively new institution in society, began to shape external values, external spheres. So the British Empire, through telegraphy and things like that. Also, of course, factories and farms. Also, medicine, of course. And among those things, areas of interest that we worked on collectively were also art worlds. And that was something that I was particularly interested in. And eventually, after a certain amount of time, I decided that it was worth a project to kind of to try and understand at this particular moment, the area of my interest, late 19th and early 20th century, how laboratory, in this case the physiology laboratory in particular, bridged this gap or how people made this, how people were able to bridge this gap to art worlds. And of course, it interested me for a number of reasons, partly because I've long been passionate about the arts, but because art and science have often been thought of as something antagonistic or fundamentally different. Creativity is often thought to be something, and particularly high modernist, late 20th century kind of ideas and across intellectual domains have reinforced this idea, the two cultures divide and so on. So to talk about a kind of sociology of translation, to put it in Latourian terms, across this divide had its own particular set of interests.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's fascinating. And so before diving into this book more deeply, I wanted to see if we could give listeners a good sense of the actors involved. So how would you place the experimental physiologists that you study within the realm of other contemporary scientific actors? For example, you know, physicists, natural historians, sometimes their interests played across these different camps, but they were also doing something new. So they were drawing on previous disciplines and also crafting new experimental terrains. And so I'm just interested in charting the landscape here a bit.
Yeah, sure. One of the things that I always like to remind people of is that physiology in the late 19th century was a central discipline. It was – nowadays we tend to think of physiology as a kind of ancillary discipline to a large extent. But in the 19th century, physiology was – often described as the queen of the sciences, a kind of cliche. It's not the only discipline that gets that label, but it often is. And when I was kind of coming up, there was a lot more work being done on 19th century physiology, and part of the interest was that it was really, in some sense, a genealogy of big science, that the largest amounts of state funding, state-funded laboratories, and really the laboratory is the university laboratory as a modern institution had its start in physiology more than in any other discipline. Physiology laboratories preceded physics and even chemistry to a large extent. That being said, physiology has a number of disparate kind of origins. The traditional story is one in which it begins in German medical schools primarily, new chairs being hived off of anatomy positions and so on, with enormous amounts of state support. That picture is I think somewhat inaccurate, partially accurate, partially accurate, inaccurate. But the main point is that it German physiology in particular enjoyed this kind of central support, and it became a kind of microcosm of an interdisciplinary science. That is to say, it drew upon chemistry, it drew upon physics, it connected with natural history and biological disciplines and so on. The interest in the kind of physiology that I'm interested in is primarily something that was called physical physiology in the 19th century, and that is a physiology that drew most of its inspiration from the physical sciences, and that was took as its primary task the measurement of bodily functions in their dynamic physical states. So the movement of the heart, the arterial pulse, and these kinds of things, and also trying to ultimately, in many respects, trying to understand a kind of physics or thermodynamics behind these kind of bodily functions. And this is where the graphical recording instruments are interesting, because they essentially had migrated from engineering and physics, and they become part of a broad attempt that could be described as trying to conceptualize the animal body as a machine in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. And so you also begin the book with, in setting your overall framework, with something of a challenge to Dassin and Galison's influential notion of mechanical objectivity, in which the subtraction of the experimental subject was a decisive aspect of scientific image making. So could you expand on this a bit more and how your work on physiologists and artists kind of provides a bit of an alternative narrative to theirs?
Sure. The work of Dassin and Galison has been extremely important for me, and I've been colleagues with both of them and have thought about it enormously. But I've never found a lot of evidence to support their claims with respect to this kind of physical physiology, except for in cases that pertain to purely visual evidence. So the kind of things that they describe with recording instruments pertain to recording instruments in cases of astronomy, for example, and personal equation studies, and to some extent in certain forms of clinical medicine, where recording instruments are taken to replace visual evidence of certain kinds. And there, the story that they talk about, a kind of receding observer and a certain kind of incipient notion of objectivity, is probably accurate to a large degree. The language of objectivity, of course, is a bit anachronistic. The 19th century, the mid-19th century, doesn't talk about it. It has a certain life amongst neo-Kantians and so on. But more importantly, the work of graphical recording instruments often really flies directly in the face of it. Experiments are often self-referential. They're often done on. They're often self-experiments. In the case of many experimenters who are not trying to remove themselves at all, but they're in fact the subject of the experiment of the experimentation. They're often interested in a whole range of kind of relays that occur between subject and object, between experimenter that make any kind of idea of a kind of neutral observer quite impossible. So it's one in which the body is rather than being something excluded, is actually being linked in a series of relays to other observers and to other and to the instruments themselves.
Mm-hmm. So it foregrounds the body more than anything else, because the work is on the body itself. That's fascinating. And so the other so as for your own theoretical frameworks, you kind of frame the two halves of the book, which, by the way, for readers, are the first is dealing more with physiology and the second more with physiological aesthetics and art. And so these two halves of the book are framed with different kind of work on systems. So in the first half, you describe Hans-Jörg Reinberger's notion of an experimental system. And then in the second part, you talk about Harry Collins's appropriation of expert systems. So I was wondering if you could spell out a bit what these two framings of kinds of systems mean for the work as sort of a map to the overall book.
Sure. So the broad outline, the broad map of the book is one, the broad argument in the book is one in which I argue that the transfer of art to science from physiology to the arts, that is this movement, this translation outward from the laboratory into the artist's studio, is one of a transfer of a kind of experimental system, that is the materialities of the laboratory to the studio. And in part, this is a corrective on a certain amount of work that's been done by art historians that wanted to, that investigated the transfer of ideas between science and arts in the 19th century, and found a certain amount of it, but often came up a little short and was unable to kind of account for the way that the art actually worked and these kinds of things. And what I discovered looking at this material more deeply was that the transfer was occurring at a much more material level, at a much more instrumental level. So that's the broad structure thing that relates the two halves of the book together. I'm very fond of Hans-Jürg Reinberger's idea of experimental systems because it describes so much of what scientists do. So many laboratory scientists, my wife is a chemist and has her own system that she works in, and she has it involves certain kinds of catalysts and so on. In the 19th century, physiology was based on, particularly this kind of physicalist physiology, was based on a set of systems around a complex of instruments with a whole lot of variables, with a whole lot of changes that one could make to produce experiments. And a lot of this work has been done very nicely on 19th century physiology by associates of Hans-Jürg Reinberger, like Henning Schmidtgen and Sven Dierig and so on. And they very, very well characterized 19th century physiology in these terms, and I found it to be an extremely helpful and a way of thinking about 19th century physiology that the field had been tending toward but hadn't quite arrived until this concept allowed them to really give it a lot more definition. And then there's a lot of particulars that can be said about it, and I go into some detail about the role of time and measurement and so on in these different kinds of systems. In the second half of the book, particularly in chapter 4, I talk about Harry Collins and expert systems in a slightly different way. When talking about I talk at length about the transfer and the various, some of the important go-betweens, some of the important figures who translate the system of experimental physiology as it existed. And this is in particular a person named Charles Henry, who was a kind of a really strange character, a kind of he's well known to historians of mathematics, interestingly enough, because he was a great historian of mathematics. He was a librarian. He'd worked in the laboratories of Claude Bernard and Paul Bert. He hung around with all these avant-garde artists, was involved in anarchist circles, kind of an amazing, strange polymathic character. But what he did primarily was to take the elements of the experimental system in physiology and adapt it to the working practices of artists. Mm. And translate it into terms that artists could understand, and particularly that allowed them to adapt it to the things that they already knew how to do. And this is an important part of work in any context, is allowing people to adapt things to skills that they already have or can be easily acquired. And Harry Collins has written very beautifully about this in many different ways, and his associates in particular. I'm citing the work of Harry Collins and Robin Evans here. And in this case, the expert systems that Harry Collins is interested in are ones that allow work. He has a whole characterization, of course, of different kinds of experts, ranging from kind of bench experts who are kind of full on our usual notion of expertise, but people who have what he calls contributory expertise, people like a lot of science studies scholars who can talk effectively to scientists and engage in the world, but aren't necessarily trained or able to carry on and do bench work in sciences and so on. In this case, some of the work that I'm interested in is transferring complicated forms of instrumental skill into simplified versions of instrumental skill that artists could apply readily within their own practices. And in this particular case, Jean-Henri devised a number of instruments, a so-called aesthetic protractor, a chromatic circle, even an olfactometer, a device that was used to provide a measurement of scents, of smells, and so on, to produce certain kinds of physiological measurements of aesthetic factors, of line, of color, of sound, of smell, and so on, in ways that were easily manipulable. And one of the best ways to think about this, I think, is to think about the great American prophet of scientific management, Frederick Winslow Taylor, and his use of the slide rule. A slide rule being an instrument that any mathematically illiterate worker or barely literate worker could perform many of the functions of a more complex mathematics simply by knowing how to manipulate a fairly simple instrument. And so too, these instruments do just that. They allow the artist to perform fairly what contain fairly complex operations, but they can do so at a level that doesn't require extreme mathematical skill.
Mm-hmm. Oh, fascinating. So I wanted to start getting into the book, actually, some of the meat of it. So in chapter one, when talking about graphical practice and fin de siècle, you argue that temporalization becomes a really key aspect of this practice, right? You can actually, in these recording instruments you've described, you can actually see the response to the stimulus and how it varies over time. But so what I'm wondering in all this is, to what extent is that theoretical framework completely sort of established through the physical instrumentation, or was it based on more preceding frameworks? So I guess this is stepping somewhat outside of the material of the book, but just to get a broader sense of, you know, what is the origin of this these concepts of seeing time?
Mm-hmm. I tend to think of it in terms of the instruments themselves. Mm-hmm. And the innovation of these instruments more broadly these recording instruments are closely connected to the development of steam power and a kind of dynamical forms of measurement in science. And this is done in many respects was done in early 19th century more by engineers than by physicists, although it becomes part of the new energy physics that emerges in the 19th century. So it's part of a kind of broad shift from, you could say, from static representations to dynamic representations, the sort of thing that we know very well from the work of Norton Wise and his work on mediating machines and some of these kind of broad shifts, where 18th century balance instruments tended to be concerned with inputs and outputs, balances and double entry bookkeeping and so on, and leave intermediate processes, and that means leaving out the temporal changes in these processes. 19th century instruments were primarily concerned with these temporal processes. One needed to know the work of the steam engine. One needed to know, in some case, the pathologies, the defects in those intermediate processes and so on. And these were inherently temporal. So, and of course, this all becomes connected in the 19th century to a broad interest in temporalizing the sciences more generally. So there's a kind of macro level of this, I think, that occurs in the 19th century of the temporalization of the sciences. But the crucial thing, I think, for the story that I want to tell and others as well, is the practical implementation of this. How does one measure dynamic processes in their temporality with specific phenomena, with specific types of instruments, with machines, and in this case, in physiology? So it's a matter of, this is applying this to the temporalization of the body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so in your second chapter, you deal with the enthusiasm around protoplasm. So which first would be great to hear, you know, what was slash is protoplasm and why it was so influential on conceptions of not just, you know, processes within the human body, but just relations between, you know, all kinds of biological bodies in nature.
Yes. So protoplasm was a kind of discovery along the way. Of course, we all know what protoplasm was, and I'm old enough to have remembered from school biology. We were still learning about protoplasm, and I even had a big model of it once when I was a kid. And then it kind of disappeared from all biology and all existence, and was kind of a dirty word. I became interested in this protoplasm business largely through the many of these people working in physiological aesthetics who kept talking about this vibrating protoplasm as a kind of substrate. And I was puzzled by it. And I went to a number of my friends who are historians of biology in the late 19th century and asked them. And many of them said, yes, there's a lot of that kind of talk around, scratch their heads. You know, there was a way in which a good deal of this had been kind of, I don't know, ignored over by historians of biology, particularly in the wake of the kind of neo-Darwinian kind of concerns, and where protoplasm was precisely the thing that had to be kind of crushed. And so there was a and as I began to kind of try to figure out where this came from, and I found my way to Huxley and to Haeckel, and then I found this vast literature in the 19th century on protoplasm. I sometimes described it as a lost continent of study that that really holds very, very strongly. So then it became a matter of understanding, in part, what this discourse was, and what the theory of heredity was, what protoplasm did in monist thought, because it linked up a number of different ideas in the conceptual architecture of particularly Haeckelian monism, which was wide, had many, many adherents, especially in science right through the 1890s, to some extent beyond, and becomes an important part of the work of these physiological aestheticians. The main thing that protoplasm did, I argue, is that it gave an account, Haeckel's theory of protoplasm in particular, the wonderfully named wave theory of protoplasm, or the paragenesis of the plastidules, was one in which in the cell, in this kind of fairly inchoate and at that point not very well described cytoplasm of the cell, there was a kind of jelly-like area. Haeckel, who was a thoroughgoing Darwinian but was never very comfortable with Darwin's own pangenesis account of heredity, wanted to propose an alternative account of how the mechanisms of heredity actually work. And in this, he proposed that the protoplasm, the gelatinous character of the protoplasm, was a waveform medium. And he takes this over from Huxley, so it had a good pedigree in this sense, that was capable of holding waveform vibratory motions. And this idea had a couple of attractive features to scientists in the 1860s and 70s. One of them is that it seemed to connect the mechanics of heredity to the kind of continuous character of a lot of physics in this area, in acoustics and electricity and so on, a kind of waveform model. And perhaps even more importantly, it connected the theory of the cell and the theory of heredity to the predominant modes of physiology, which tried to register these kind of waveform periodic motions of physiological functions. And so Haeckel elaborated a theory that starts off with simple primitive protoplasm and also protozoic organisms, through which heredity is something that's stored in these waveform motions in the cells and then is passed on through cell division and through normal sexual reproduction to other animals, to other cells, but over the course of the development of evolution, it differentiates along with the cells, and the differentiations correspond to the differentiations of function. And Haeckel began to imagine the entire organismic trees that he was fond of presenting as a story of vibratory protoplasm from single-celled organisms to complex organisms, humans at the top usually, in the kind of anthropocentric models that he produced, where the most highly differentiated vibratory protoplasm would then be found in humans and so on. And it could correspond as well to psychology. It had a psychological dimension as well that was vibratory. This is a view that it was highly speculative, But it was plausible within a kind of conceptual architecture of the late 19th century. And for that reason, we see a lot of highly respectable people, many of whom renounced the theory later, but it was widely adhered to and explained a lot of things in the late 19th century. So protoplasm becomes, in some sense, the ontology or the substrate of a vibratory world which the instrumental features of graphical recording operate. That is to say, gives a kind of ontology to the a biological ontology to these recording systems, to this kind of experimental system that that had come into being.
So that explains, in a way, variations between pulses and sort of, these variables charted over time can be sort of seen in that as matter.
That's right.
Interesting. And so then, I guess, shifting to perhaps, a few levels up kind of the organismal tree, you talk about the actual work of linguistics using some of these physiological apparatuses. So I'm wondering, first of all, I guess, what was linguistics like, I guess, more linked up with philology before these kinds of recording devices? And then how did these transform that theory?
But let me back up and just say one more thing about the protoplasm.
Yeah.
Haeckel's model of protoplasm had codified into a model where I have an image from Alfred Binet from the late 1870s that codifies, that shows this quite. It's a picture from his laboratory where he has a picture of an infusoria, a single-celled organism, on one side, the human brain on the other, and the recording instrument in the middle. So what you're doing is
fascinating image.
you're trying to sort of to measure these kinds of vibrations. So one of the crucial aspects of this is that this ontology also in the end becomes a kind of what you could say an anthropology, that is an account of human nature within this evolutionary framework. And that's important for the linguistics because linguistics embarks on a similar kind of trajectory. Linguistics, like every discipline, has its own story in a way. Part of the story I tell is one in which the an older discipline of philology was adapted to this new physiological graphical recording program. So from the early 19th century, the beginnings of philology as a science, of course, well documented and a crucial, a central science in German universities in the early 19th century, had been largely a textual discipline. With Franz Bopp and a range of others, and of course had begun to chart the relations between Indo-European languages, Sanskrit, proto-Sanskrit had begun on the basis of the kind of morphology of sounds and linguistic structures to chart these long historical relations. In the 1860s and 1870s, this model, which had always had a slightly organic, an organicist kind of tinge to it in the work of these German philologists, had become adapted to a Darwinian model to a large extent through the work of particularly of August Schleicher, a German. So the model of linguistics was even more biologized in that sense. But it remained a textual discipline, one in which you were concerned, people were concerned with the words on the page, with the written word, and sound was seen as something secondary. Even though when people were studying sound shifts and so on, it was sound only as mediated through language.
Mm-hmm.
Beginning in the 1860s and 70s, as some of these physiologists began to apply these graphical recordings to vocalization, they began to realize that they could do things that were important. They could say things about linguistics and vocalization and phonetics that no one had ever been able to say before. And in many respects, they could get at phenomena in a more primary way than mere textualists had done. Ernst Brucke, one of the pioneers of this kind of thing, compared it to the difference between doing real anatomy and a kind of pre-Vesalian anatomy where it was all about the anatomy texts rather than actual dissections, and gradually dissection kind of runs ahead of the authority of the text. And there's something analogous to that going on here, where they begin to do recordings of all sorts of vocalization. They become interested in the different ways that vocal sounds are produced. They begin to understand that vocal sounds, and it varies from language to language, are produced not just in the mouth but in the chest, and there's a whole range of different organs of phonation involved, and so on. Along the way, Ernst Brucke does a pioneering study of the vocalization of poetry as well, of German poetry, of North German verse. And one of the things that he's keen to show in this is that the actual way that sounds are made in the recitation, the professional recitation of poetry, doesn't correspond at all to the rules that the rules of grammarians and the theorists of prosody have handed down. And those were, of course, in German, had been theories of language that had been adapted essentially from classical languages, from Greek and Latin, and had sort of forced German into this kind of classical Procrustean bed. And Brucke shows that actually it doesn't work that way at all. It's actually going completely against the grain of a lot of these rules, and one has to kind of continually look the other way to see how the language is actually working. Meanwhile, in France in particular, a generation of linguists using these new instruments begin to map out patois and become interested in producing linguistic maps of France. And this idea spreads throughout Europe. They develop instruments that they can take into the field and graphically record. This is before the phonograph. Later, the phonograph tends to take over a lot of these kinds of studies. But initially, they're going out and they're graphically recording the different dialects across the country, and they're producing maps of the small shifts over geographical space in these various sounds, and they're very interested in how people essentially socially calibrate one another to be able to understand how in the world can people in a village understand a particular dialect and people in the next village not understand it. Everyone speaks the same way in one village and not in the other, and this leads to a lot of reflection on the kind of muscular training, the particular kind of skill that speaking language involves, and so on. And this idea, this approach to language, comes as a bit of a revolution within linguistic science, and comes as a huge challenge to to a more textually oriented philology. Well, some of the problems are well known, and one sees these tensions if you're readers of people who might have read Saussure and so on, sees this kind of tension in Saussure's work between phonetics and a more textually oriented linguistic science. So that's the kind of broad trajectory of linguistic science. But with it comes a certain kind of image of humans as well as kind of neuromuscular imitators, that we're kind of empathic imitators of one another, and we calibrate our own muscular gestures to interactions with one another. And this is true of language, but it's also true of gesture and other forms of expression.
Mm-hmm. And so going straight actually to the kind of artistic implications of that work in linguistics, I wanted to go ahead to your chapter on poetry because I found it interesting, and it didn't so much like stand out amidst the rest of the material like as being totally disparate, but because the subject matter is not purely visual and the book is full of so many great diagrams and illustrations, it does sort of like it is kind of a thing of itself. So I was wondering if you could describe the difficulties actually involved in working with poetry in a book that's about art and aesthetics, and sort of how you mediated that and what that chapter does for you.
Yes, and in fact, in many ways, it's my favorite chapter in the book. So I felt like things really came together through that work. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of things to say about it. One thing to say about it is that the poets that I'm concerned with, who really lead this innovation in poetry, were socially very close to the artists that I'm concerned with. So they were in constant conversation with them. This is a small group of people. But it points to one of the central problems that this movement of transfer from the lab to the studio involves. That is to say, how do you translate the laboratory into things that people already know how to do? And that means how to do within the work of a specific artistic medium. And as you say, poetry is entirely different from painting in this respect. And as I didn't fully appreciate beforehand, it's every bit as technical as anything else. Prosody is a very technical business, and it was for these poets as well. The main concern that they have, so they're very fascinated by the work of these of Broca and then of a number of French physiologists on vocalization, beginning with Étienne Jules Maret, extending to Abbé Rousselot, who becomes the real giant of French phonetics in the early 20th century. And they attend the Rousselot's lectures and Maret's lectures at the Collège de France, and they're interested in this kind of thing, and they're very interested in the way in which this finding that poetry, that real poetry doesn't correspond to the way that the rules of prosody as they've been handed down. Now, these are kind of avant-garde anarchists. They think that the conventions and rules of the past are stifling. In particular, one needs to remember that that in the French case, a little bit different from that in English and some other languages, the rules of prosody are codified by the French Academy, by the Académie Française, and the rules of the French, the default French form of poetry, the Alexandrine form, were codified in the 17th century with great poets like Racine and Boileau and various others. And so it has a very fixed metric structure modeled on classical Greek and Latin structures. According to the kind of traditional French idea, there's no real getting around it. That's just the natural form that poetry takes in French. And you can bend it and twist it a little bit, and poets had tried to do that. But it was kind of locked into a very fixed syllabic metrical structure. So everything about this was anathema to these avant-garde poets. They hated the state domination of the poetry. They didn't like the kind of rules. They wanted to get around it. And they saw a chance to do this in this new physiology. Mm-hmm. But the question then became how to translate the physiology into the poetry. And in this case, they began to talk about the temporalities of the of poetry, the temporalities of poetry as a spoken language, in contrast to the temporalities marked by classical metrical structures. And graphic recordings of the voice had their own temporalities to them. You could see rises and pitches. You could see various moments of aspiration in the formate in the making of different kinds of sounds, and so on. And so they began to, initially in a somewhat speculative way, although eventually then they began to really do a lot of experimental work on this, began to think about what in poetry is the central problem of lineation, that is to say, the length of a line, the metrical structure of the line, the moments of accent to these. And they began to, first of all, the first task was to show how real lived poetry, even Alexandrine poetry, didn't actually follow the rules. So the first point was nobody follows the rules anyway. It just looks that way on the page, and professors of literature all make it look like it all fits, but it really doesn't. but the corollary to that was the possibility of a new free verse, as they called it, a vers libre is the French term. And the idea was, if that's the case, why hold to this model of this rigid model of poetry? Why not allow verse to be free, to operate according to different kinds of structures? And with this, then they began to adopt the same kinds of models that the painters were adopting. They began to look for the smallest possible units. They began to look for small rhythmic units that then could be built into larger structures. The other idea is that you could communicate the physiological rhythm of the poet, him or herself, directly into the poem, which would then be recovered by the reader or auditor of the poem. So there's a kind of physiological communication between that would work from poet to poetic work to beholder, to the artistic spectator. that could be that forms a whole a model of a transitive communication, a kind of physiological model that corresponds entirely to the model that the linguists were busy articulating. And it was highly imitative. It corresponded to this kind of neuromuscular imitation model that linguists were operating under, and so on. But the crucial point, one of the crucial points for these poets are real dedicated anarchists in a way. They want to smash the old form of the Alexandrine and create something new. And the idea, in direct correspondence with anarchist theories of things. Anarchists believe that the received institutions of the world were all deeply corrupted in some sense, needed to be smashed, and a new, more harmonious, new, truer to nature kinds of institutions needed to grow up in their place. And so this would happen in the domain of poetry, as it would hopefully happen in the domain of banks and political institutions and a range of other things.
Mm-hmm. And those sensibilities definitely extended to the artistic community with which, as you say, the poets were constantly commingling with. So I wanted to then transition into the work on physiological aesthetics in art. And I think that a good way to do that from the book is actually to focus on a figure that you take up sort of the end of that first chapter in the section. You take a large part of that chapter to talk about him. So I was wondering if you could expound on Georges Seurat as such a well-known figure, and how he kind of fits in culturally and theoretically to this movement. What does he derive from physiological aesthetics? To what extent is, his camp of neo-impressionism involved in mediating these new definitions and technologies and then disseminating them to the broader community, as you discuss with the use of expert systems?
Yeah, yeah. So Seurat is the in this period, the most important artist for my story, and by any account, he's one of the most important artists of this late 19th century period. Seurat was very involved in this group of avant-garde circle with these poets. Gustave Kahn was one of his closest friends. Jules Laforgue was a friend. A number of other poets, and this figure of Jean Henri. This has been well known by art historians for a long time, and it's been well known that he was very interested in science. Initially, his early work was interested in the work of Helmholtz and Chevreul, but he turns largely to the work of Jean Henri as his kind of guru, I guess you could say. He attends Henri's lectures at the Sorbonne, these kind of evening public lectures that Henri gave, and along with it, a number of artists, Camille Pissarro, Paul Signac, a range of these people attended these lectures. Art historians have often been interested in the transmission of the conceptual ideas and how they might have worked to made it into Seurat's work. But as you've mentioned, I'm interested in the way that Seurat was interested in translating this directly into into the paintings themselves. Now, he wasn't the only one. In fact, his good friend Paul Signac was every bit as avid to do this and painted. Used this kind of expert system, as I describe it, also in all of his works. Not as great an artist as Seurat in many, many ways. Much more of a rote kind of painter. Still a good painter, but not an artist at the same level as Seurat. One of the things that's fascinating about this group of people is that they're a kind of second-generation independent artists. That is to say, the independent movement that begins with Manet and the Impressionists with Renoir and Monet and all those sorts of people, Degas, people who showed their works independently of the Salon. This group comes along. They're a little bit younger. They want to establish an identity for themselves separate from that older generation of people. Their painting is in many ways in the same vein, but they define themselves in some respects in antagonistic terms to the Impressionists. And yet they're thrown in with them to a certain extent. One of their main concerns is how to establish art in a world free of salon patronage. So up until this point, all arts have been controlled by state salons, by systems of painters. Artists have been trained largely in state institutions, academies of Beaux-Arts and so on, as was Seurat, in fact. and they were interested in how to sell their paintings, quite simply, in this world, which they thought was on one hand a free market world, but it was an anarchist world as they understood it as well. So part of what they wanted was a means for gaining control over their painting and over the effects of their painting on the viewer. So they thought that in a market-based economy where things weren't mediated through all of these mediators and all the expectations that traditional conventions of painting would have, they could use the new psychophysiological aesthetic to gain control, to paint in a way that they could have calculable effects on the viewers themselves, that the viewers would experience joy or anguish or sadness, a whole catalog of emotions. They would find paintings vitalizing or inhibiting as they wanted. They could even make it a little more complicated and bring various kinds of complicated contradictions into the paintings in these kinds of ways, or different parts of the work and so on. So there was a movement to gain control over the work, and the science, this new physiological aesthetics, seemed to offer that to them. And so it was very attractive to them in this way. And as anarchists, the anarchists in this period were very pro-science. The leading anarchist theorists, Kropotkin and Reclus and so on, were mostly scientists themselves. So it all fit to a certain kind of picture, using science to gain control over a certain kind of market. And so Seurat was a and this applied to all the dimensions of physiological aesthetics, to the measurement of line, to the measurement of color, and so on. One important feature of their work, another little piece in this larger puzzle, was that they were also aesthetically committed Wagnerians. And what that means, they were drawn to Richard Wagner's theory of the total work of art, the Gesamtkunstwerk. And they had this idea that art should... every work of art should embody all the other works of all the other genres of art. So painting should have a musical component, should have a poetic component, should evoke these kinds of things through some technique that would produce a kind of synesthesia in a way. And the psychophysiology provided a model for inducing synesthetic effects in the viewer. So it promised all these kinds of things. And so Seurat painted according to these methods. They were widely publicized by various figures closely associated with the neo-impressionist movement, above all a figure, the writer Félix Fénéon, who was one of the most trenchant art critics of the late 19th century, tried to explain these theories to the public on how these things were working, and so on. And it all was going swimmingly for a while. But at a certain point, there was a bit of an artistic backlash. People began to make the charge that all this scientific painting, all this attempts to sort of calculate the various elements of the painting, didn't it produce a kind of mechanical painting, something that was done as if by a machine? And if so, what does that mean for art in a way? And above all, the charge that particularly stung Seurat was the idea that he wasn't really a creative genius. He wasn't the great artist that he pretended to. He was lucky enough to happen upon a scientific method that allowed him to produce this work. So in this sense, he could be seen as a kind of high-level hack rather than a great artist. Some of the other artists weren't particularly concerned with this, but this bothered Seurat. But the genius of Seurat, I argue, in his late works, and unfortunately Seurat died at the age of 31, so all the paintings we have of Seurat were done in a very short amount of time. In his last works, he began to draw an analogy between the problem of mechanization. This idea of mechanization in painting that was offered by the psychophysiological aesthetics and broader debates that were going along in society about mechanization. So the mechanization of all sorts of different domains was something that was hotly debated, and particularly in anarchist circles. There were a lot of disputes about what the meaning of machines were. Were they expropriating? Were they something good that gave people more free time at the end and were liberating workers? Or were they something that was enslaving workers? And Seurat realized that there was a direct analogy between those questions and the use of this new kind of technique in the arts. Did it liberate the artist, or did it actually enslave the artist in some ways? And in some of his late paintings, I argue, he actually made this problem the theme of the painting, where the question of the mechanical production of the painting and in the content of the painting, the question of whether mechanism was something socially enslaving or something progressive, were built into the concepts. They're highly self-reflexive paintings. They were reflexive on society, but they were also reflecting at the same time about the problems, the questions that were inherent in this new physiological aesthetic model of the arts and the artwork.
Mm-hmm. And you have a really good description of this regarding his painting Le Chahut, which is like, you know, a description of a typical kind of body Moulin Rouge-esque, you know, performance. When you, and I think the way you describe it, it's still open to the interpretation of the viewer, whether it is like the kind of mechanization of labor for pleasure or, you know, or otherwise, whether, you know, it's actually, whether this represents some horizon of like future automation, right? So there's a way in which people who are, you know, in these kind of, you know, lower class positions having to entertain wealthy gentlemen are sort of already stuck within this mechanized grid. Right. And so it sort of allows you to ponder that situation and then further allows you to ponder like the possibility of the, you know, the mechanization of the entire situation. So maybe the eventual even replacement of the human.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The canvas itself is a dense surface that I argue is really more fully realizes the transfer of this experimental system onto the work of art than anything else. But then the social content was very disturbing. You don't know whether this is a kind of liberating this dance is a kind of liberating scenario, and there's a bunch of kind of bourgeois sort of lurid spectators with kind of pig-like features and so on in the looking on, and whether these dancers, these female dancers, are being turned into kind of slavish machines, or whether they're operating at a certain kind of position of superiority or liberation from those who are coming to see their performances and so on. And so that it's a wonderful paradox. And in fact, it was something that was very controversial. There were big debates about the meaning of these paintings in the leading anarchist publications. Hmm. People didn't know that there was a certain amount of anarchist suspicion about where Seurat's loyalties actually lay. And I think he was actually a little vexed. I think that he was actually interested in posing the question in a more kind of urgent way. He wasn't as dogmatic an anarchist. He was a kind of anarchist fellow traveler, but he was less dogmatic than his friend Paul Signac, who tended to be a kind of party line sort of guy. And that's the fascination of a great artist, is that he raised this technique then to a kind of question in and of itself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so we're kind of beginning to run a little bit short on time, but I was wondering if you could kind of quickly address the content of the last couple of chapters, the first being on synesthesia and the second one being on kinesthetics. So the blending of senses and then movement as a sense incorporated into art itself.
Yes. So part of what happens as this theory and these working methods become more and more established is the a broader interest in extending them to new kinds of questions. The one chapter on synesthesia deals with that question, that Wagnerian question that I mentioned mm-hmm. earlier, and how the protoplasm actually became the way of anchoring this kind of Wagnerian model. So Wagner was interested in synesthesia as a general phenomenon, and he was interested in anchoring in his operas. In producing a whole set of synesthetic effects, where you would invoke sound with color and color with sound, and all these kinds of things, these late 19th century French avant-gardes were very interested in this. But protoplasm theories provided there were theorists of protoplasm. These various psychophysiologists were busy developing an account of the medical pathology of synesthesia, which they saw as a failure of protoplasm to differentiate at a certain point. So there were various forms that this took. Protoplasm might not differentiate. The waveforms might not differentiate, and one might actually be stuck at a kind of atavistic state of pre-differentiation. And this could have a lot of things. I mean, there's a theory of a kind of virtuous theory of homosexuality that's quite widespread around this period. Edward Carpenter was a big in Britain was a big proponent of this kind of this idea. But synesthesia was another one. Shamanism was another thing. So people who were kind of the idea was that the division of the senses was in some sense a fall, was some sense a condition of advancement in society through civilization in our own evolution, but it left us unable to naturally connect things that had been once been undifferentiated. So it's a very kind of ingenious and somewhat curious idea. It also leads to the general issue that every artist in the late 19th century has to claim to be synesthetic, whether they are or not. A great number are, turns out, but everyone needs to be able to sort of claim to be. And this becomes part of a kind of incitement to produce synesthetic works, and it becomes a characteristic of early modernism, all the way from Strindberg and Munch, all the way to Alexander Scriabin and so on, and Kandinsky, to produce works that invoke synesthetic effects. Kinesthesia is another issue that comes about around the same time. So synesthesia is the kind of synthesis of the senses, of the five senses into one or a set of interlocking senses. Kinesthesia is something like a sixth sense, perhaps a master sense that physiologists become interested in the 1890s. Earlier, they described it as something called the muscle sense. It has an older history in the 19th century, but they began to call it kinesthesia in the 1890s. Later, it becomes more proprioception and other things. So mm-hmm. The word kinesthesia kind of disappears to some extent. But the idea is that there's a kind of sixth sense, a master sense, a muscle sense, which holds perception together. And one of the things that happens, the general kind of theory of aesthetic perception that emerges from physiological aesthetics in this period becomes dominated by kinesthesia. So a range of the effects that were described in the earlier chapters become kind of categorical, what could be described as kind of categorical perceptual differences. All the small kind of emotional, affective manipulations that could be calculated and brought in. But the broader kind of condition of kinesthesia was the one that made the whole thing possible. And this is a theory that emerges, that really comes into full bloom by about 1910 and really carries on right through to about 1930 in the arts in a large way. And that is a certain model of what people came to call kinesthetic empathy. Empathy itself is a word, is a translation of a German word. It's a coinage. Coined in 1909 by Edward Titchener to translate the German word Einfühlung, a feeling into, which was initially a purely aesthetic term. And the idea was our kinesthetic sense allows us to feel into a work of art, to feel the movements of the line, to feel the movements, say, of music or color and so on, and we feel them bodily. And that's the primary mode of perceiving artworks. Is through this kind of empathic model. And then within that, a whole range of other specific effects occur. So around 1910, this model begins to take over. And it takes over at a certain moment of a certain mutation within the avant-garde arts, a certain kind of moment in modernism. It's the moment of futurism. It's the moment of cubism. It's the moment of really the moment of a certain kind of abstract expressionism and so on. And abstract expressionism, a good deal of futurist art and so on, all embody this kinesthetic sense, this mm-hmm. this dynamic perception of movement taken in by the body. And everyone who's working in these, from people that I write about, Picabia as a major cubist figure interested in this kind of thing, to F.T. Marinetti and many of the futurists are interested in theorizing art along this model of kinesthetic empathy, which interestingly has a corollary nowadays in a lot of kind of empathy motor neuron theories and so on that have been put forth in cognitive neuroscience. This was all done without any motor neurons or any kind of brain fMRI kinds of studies, but was done with these models, these kinds of physiological instruments, and a good deal of kind of speculative descriptive psychology as well. Mm-hmm. And this model becomes this is the dominant model of arts on the eve of the First World War. As I say, it continues after the war. And then there's a bit of a backlash against all of this by the 1920s.
Right, right. And then, as you say, it sort of continues in a sense in America, but not so much in post-war Europe.
That's right. It interestingly enough, it has its adherents in Europe, but there's a kind of rationalistic backlash. Some of it has to do with the war itself. There were people who made the charge that European intellectuals had been so drawn to physiological aesthetics and Bergsonism, which had become fairly merged together, that they had become vulnerable to demagogues. They had become prisoners of feeling, intensities of feeling that allowed for the kind of irrational analyses that led to the First World War was all part of this. And what was needed was a more directive rationality that in the arts and in culture more generally. But as this happened, the European theories migrated to the United States on the one hand, and interestingly to the Soviet Union, where they became, in both cases, entrenched in art schools, where American and Soviet art schools in the 1920s were busy teaching all these theories, and all of the major artists from this period, from George O'Keefe and Arthur Dove in the United States and a range of Soviet artists and so on, were deeply steeped in these kinds of things. And in Europe, they were more in the decline, although there are bits and pieces around.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, Robert, thank you so much. And just to wrap things up, we like to ask people what they're actually working on now. So I'd love for you to expound on that a bit.
Well, apart from a certain amount of work, I've joined forces with a number of other people. There's a kind of growing interest in physiological aesthetics, and I have a couple of collaborative projects with people where we're trying to map out a larger kind of international network. But my other work is actually going in a somewhat different direction, still interested in the lab and the world, but from a different perspective. I'm interested in 19th century chemistry and agriculture. And I'm interested in kind of the global spread of fertilizer and scientific agriculture in the 19th century. So there's an element of continuity and an element of complete something entirely different.
Great. Well, Robert, thank you so much for your time. And to listeners, I hope you've enjoyed. This has been New Books in Science, Technology, and Society.